From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. One little boy born in London yesterday, third in line to the British throne, doesn't have to worry too much about his prospects in life. The jewels and palaces are pretty well laid out. For most people in this world, a way to get ahead is a big deal. The United States was long the world capital of upward mobility. Lately, not so much. But it turns out, it matters a lot where you live within this country, where you begin. This hour on Point, upward mobility in America and the new map of American opportunity. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see in your community? Are your poorest neighbor's kids getting ahead? Does this country, your town, feel to you like a place where a person can make it up from the bottom? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from New York is David Leonhardt, Washington Bureau Chief for the New York Times. He's been covering a big new study. You can link to his page one story and interactive map through our website, onpointradio.org. David Leonhardt, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be back.
So here we are. I'm looking at this map right now, and we've got an unbelievable variation in this country. We've heard the story about how overall upward mobility has declined, but it really matters where you begin. What did this study find, David?
So I know you'll be talking to Raj Chetty later, who's one of the authors, and what the four authors did was they analyzed millions of earnings records over three decades or longer. And what they tried to do was track the odds of a kid born into one kind of family rising above to another. So if you're growing up as a poor kid, what are your odds of reaching the middle class or beyond in Atlanta? What are your odds of doing so in New York, in San Francisco? And they found really stark regional patterns. And they weren't just about which areas are wealthy and which areas are poor. They found big differences between cities with relatively similar income. And the shortest summary of it is that the Southeast and the industrial Midwest have considerably lower rates of upward mobility than the Northeast, the Great Plains, and the Far West.
Throw out some cities within that, David, and what they found. Give us some example. And what is it exactly that they measured? Children from what getting to where?
So what they measured was children who were born around 1980. They looked at their family's income when they were kids, and then they looked at their income when they were in their early 30s. And although people obviously make a lot more money after they turn 30 and their salary goes up typically, there's a strong relationship between where in the distribution you are when you're about 30 and where you end up later.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very telling. So you asked for specific cities. I mean, what I find to be in some ways the starkest comparison is that if you take a typical poor kid in a high mobility city like Seattle, a kid at the 25th percentile of the family income distribution, and you say, what can we expect his or her earnings will be as an adult? You'd expect they'd be quite low because that person grew up poor, and as you said, there's not a massive amount of upward mobility in this country. There's some, but there's not a massive amount. That poor kid from Seattle has as high lifetime expected earnings as a middle-class kid from Atlanta, which is a way of saying that in Atlanta, if you come from Atlanta, it's much harder to climb the ladder than if you come from Seattle. So some of the lowest rates are Atlanta, Charlotte, Indianapolis, Memphis. Think about a belt that stretches from Michigan south through Indiana and Ohio down into Tennessee and down into Mississippi and Georgia and South Carolina. That's where mobility tends to be lowest. And then in places where it tends to be highest, Boston, New York, Salt Lake City really pops off the chart, Seattle, San Francisco, as well as some smaller cities, Scranton, Harrisburg, much of Minnesota and the Dakotas. These are places where more kids who start out poor end up doing pretty well. And so, then obviously the big question becomes why?
Yes, well, look at that. I'm looking at some of the numbers here. Salt Lake City, you mentioned, way up there, 11.5%, Atlanta 4.4%. What does that mean? 11.5% does what? 4% do what?
So that is the odds that a kid raised in the bottom fifth of the national income distribution end up as adults in the top fifth. You don't want to put too much importance on any one number, but the fact is the numbers are very consistent. If you looked at the odds that a kid in the bottom two-fifths would make it to the upper two-fifths, you see very similar patterns. So what that means is 4% of kids who grow up in the bottom fifth of the income distribution in Atlanta end up in the top fifth. 96% of them end up somewhere lower.
And that's only about a third of the number that would make that same pole vault in Salt Lake City.
That's exactly right. So you often see between the worst and the best, you often see factors of two or three. One other really interesting thing is that it matters more, geography matters more if you're poor or middle class than if you're rich. The odds of kids who come from high-income families staying in the upper part of the income distribution don't vary all that much geographically. So if you're a high-income kid in California or in Georgia, you're sort of roughly similarly likely to remain a high-income kid.
I mean, that's comforting for those families, but overall it speaks to this diminished mobility that we see as a country. You kind of stay where you start.
Yeah, that's right. And it also is consistent in other ways, which is these local factors, such as the variation in school quality, the variation in single-parent family rates, the variation in the integration between poor and middle-class communities. Those are all factors the researchers found correlated pretty clearly with differences in mobility. So if you're from a place with a higher divorce rate, more single-parent families, if you're from a place with worse elementary schools test scores and worse high school graduation rates, if you're from a place where the poor tend to live separate from the middle class, your odds of rising the ladder are lower. But you could imagine why all those factors don't affect affluent families quite as much. Affluent families, almost no matter where they are able to get their kids good educations and are able to overcome some of these geographic differences.
Another of the factors they cite was engagement with religious or community organizations. How does that map with this map of the low mobility areas? We think of the South-Southeast as a more religious part of the country, and yet we don't see the mobility there.
That's right. I mean, if you look at any one area and try to compare it to any one factor, you could say, well, wait a second, does that make sense?
Yep.
The Southeast is fairly religious. But the fact is, when you look at every place, you find, I mentioned three before, education, family structure, and what you might call economic segregation. But you just mentioned the fourth, which is this bowling alone theory, right, which is that communities where people are more engaged, where they join groups, including churches, including bowling leagues, including the PTA, those communities tend to be healthier. They found a relationship between that as well. So, and that makes some sense. I went down to Atlanta to talk to people there about why they think mobility may be lower. There are huge numbers of them mentioned this geography problem, the fact that in Atlanta, poor communities, lower-income communities are often far away from middle and upper-income communities where there tend to be more jobs, traffic is bad, public transportation is pretty weak. But something else I heard from people who were struggling to get up is someone said to me, you know, I'm a loner. I don't know a ton of people, and that's made it harder for me to search for my job. And you could imagine why that would be the case. If you belong to a church, if you belong to a PTA, if you belong to a sports league,
sure.
You know, you'd say to someone, hey, I'm looking for a job, and they'd say, guess what? You know, I know about this opening over here.
And off you go. It's not geographically monolithic. I mean, I can look down here in the South at Texarkana, very strong rate, 9%+, or Houston, 8%+, relatively good mobility in those southern locations. It's not like it's just a solid bummer in this part of the country. What about those variations within regions?
Yeah, you picked out what I found to be the most interesting exception, which was Houston. I mean, Houston really has a notably higher upward mobility rate than the other cities of Texas, big cities of Texas or the South. And so, there clearly is some variation, and there's some variation at the top as well. Chicago kind of looks like it's half a major metro area, one of the sort of central metro areas, which tend to have higher mobility, and it's half in the Midwest, so it sort of is in between, not so great at 6%. The thing I would say is that if you didn't really see any geographic patterns in this map, it would be reasons to doubt that they were finding something real here.
Mm-hmm.
But and if it were perfectly uniform, it'd be reason to doubt they were finding something real. It would be too neat. But to me, this map kind of makes some sense when you look at it, which is there are clear regional patterns, right? There are regions
Absolutely.
That are worse than others. It's not like being 100 miles away from a bad mobility region wouldn't tell you anything about what mobility was likely to be in your region. If you're close to a bad mobility region, you're probably bad. I mean, on our map on the Times' homepage, you'll see the Southeast and Indiana and Michigan and Ohio are really quite red, which is low mobility.
It's a great map. I really encourage our listeners to click through to it. You can play around all day thinking talking about where you're from and your relatives in different parts of the country. Let me ask you this, David. I don't know if you've paid attention, but to these international comparisons, we've heard again and again in recent years, upward mobility is stronger in other countries that we used to kind of look down on. I mean, Canada right next door, a bunch of European countries. When I look, what about the top American cities? Are they in the league of those countries outside the U.S. with more mobility?
Well, they are. That's the good news. I mean, we don't have comparing data in different studies and across different data sets. It's always a little bit tricky.
Yes.
The best that we can tell, the highest mobility U.S. cities, the Seattles, the Salt Lake cities, the San Franciscos, the smaller cities in Minnesota and Scranton, and to some extent the bigger cities of the Northeast, they are in the same league as some of these European countries. I mean, Salt Lake City, which in some ways stands out as the number one mobility place in this country, you know, can play on the mobility charts with a place like Denmark. But the cities with relatively low mobility look like no other rich country. I mean, they have worse mobility, which then you think about where the American average would be. It would make sense that our average would be lower than a lot of other countries. And that is to some extent a puzzle. I mean, look, we have more egalitarian traditions in this country than other countries do. On the other hand, we also have much higher inequality, and some parts of our safety net are not as good. And you could imagine why greater inequality essentially pushes the rungs on the ladder further apart and makes it harder for people across races. And that's one of the interesting things about this. The thing that's not explaining the study is race. It plays a fairly minor role. Makes it harder for people to climb that ladder.
For this country, with its historic promise of opportunity, which has been the glue of this country in so many ways politically, this is a big, big deal. This map is new. We're going to talk in a moment with one of its authors. Can't wait. David Leonhardt with the New York Times. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American cities where you can move up in the world and cities where it is a whole lot harder. In a time when upward mobility in America overall has slowed, a big new study tracks for the first time the best and worst places to get ahead. We're going to talk in just a moment with one of the authors of that research, that story. Lots of people talking about this, including the president. He's making a big economic speech this week in Illinois. In 11, he was in Kansas, Osawatomie, Kansas, talked about the dangers that inequality can and does pose to the American dream.
Over the last few decades, the rungs on the ladder of opportunity have grown farther and farther apart. And the middle class has shrunk. You know, a few years after World War II, a child who was born into poverty had a slightly better than 50-50 chance of becoming middle class as an adult. By 1980, that chance had fallen to around 40%. And if the trend of rising inequality over the last few decades continues, it's estimated that a child born today will only have a 1 in 3 chance of making it to the middle class. 33%.
President Obama pointing out the problem. Raj Chetty is one of the economists who has laid it out in a whole new kind of clarity for it. He's with me in the studio today, professor of economics at Harvard University, co-director of the Public Economics Group at the National Bureau of Economic Research, one of the four authors of a detailed new study on income mobility in the United States, MacArthur Genius Fellowship winner, and just this year won the John Bates Clark Medal to that. It's a big deal in economic circles for the most promising, most accomplished young economist in the country. He's with me in the studio. Raj Chetty, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Name your co-authors on this study, which is turning so many heads.
My co-authors are Nathan Hendren, my colleague at Harvard, Patrick Klein at Berkeley, and Emmanuel Saez at Berkeley.
How do you look at the map that's emerged out of this? Did it surprise you?
Absolutely. The map certainly surprised us because we weren't expecting such a great deal of heterogeneity across the U.S., so much variation in the degree of mobility across cities. You know, the way we were thinking about it is often the question people ask is the U.S. still the land of opportunity?
Mm-hmm.
And what we're finding here is maybe that's not the right question to be asking. There are some places that are lands of opportunity, if you like, and there are other places that are probably better described as lands of persistent inequality. And so it really
matters.
Within
the United States.
Within the United States. And so it really matters where you live.
So if people ask, is it still the land of opportunity? The answer is yes and no, depending on where you fall on this map. This is so detailed, it suggests you must have collected a lot of data. How'd you put this together, broadly speaking?
So broadly speaking, we use statistics compiled from anonymous earnings records covering, you know, millions of people. This is a set of children born in the early 1980s in the U.S., and we're looking at their earnings today when they're about 30 years old. And we look at how their parents' income compares to their own income to determine who moves up in the income distribution.
I mean, these percentages that we're reeling off here, San Francisco 11.2, L.A. 9.6, and those are good. Boston 9.8, New York 9.7, Houston 8.4, Texarkana, Arkansas 9.1%. These are going from the bottom fifth of income to the top fifth. So you didn't just – we just heard President Obama talking about making it to the middle class. You put a higher bar out there, more of a Horatio Alger bar.
So we looked at the statistics in various ways. You can define upward mobility in many different ways, as you're suggesting. It can be from the bottom fifth to the top fifth. It could be from the bottom half to the top half. Spatially, the patterns that we're seeing, they all line up no matter which statistics you look at. So, of course, it's going to be less likely that you move from the bottom fifth to the top fifth than moving, say, from poverty into the middle class. But the places that are very good in the Horatio Alger sort of going from the bottom to top are also the same places that are good in pushing people into the middle class from poverty.
Let's look at this map in a little more detail. It is very interesting. I mean, we're talking about major cities with big numbers here, but if you get into smaller communities, I mean, not so small, but Nebraska City, way up high there, 16.9, way above Salt Lake City. I mean, Fargo, North Dakota, 13%, Sioux Falls, 12%, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, 12.6%. These are quite strong numbers. You know, Fairbanks, Alaska, 14%. So some of the smaller cities have even higher mobility than the major cities you're citing.
That's absolutely right. In fact, we find that some of the highest mobility places in America are smaller towns rather than the biggest cities. So Dubuque, Iowa, to take another example, extremely high rates of upward mobility. And what's very interesting about those places to us is what's happening in those communities is that they're producing these very successful kids, even kids from low-income families, and they end up leaving those communities typically, moving to bigger cities and being very successful in the broader American economy. But they're being produced in these smaller towns.
Clustered right around Salt Lake City with its strong showing. You've got others, Santa Barbara, California, 11.8, a little higher than Salt Lake. You've got Des Moines, Iowa, 11.1, right up there. But then down at the low end, I mean, some of these numbers get just shockingly low, like nobody's moving. Famously, on your chart, you've got Atlanta with just 4% from the bottom quintile to the top. Charlotte with 4.3%, Memphis 3.6 or something like that. I mean, it's way down there. Indianapolis is just 4.8. Who knew? Savannah, Georgia, 4.5. Were you surprised at how low some of these got?
It is surprising. Take a place like Memphis where the numbers are less than 3% in many cases. I mean, what that's telling you is it is really
2.6%. I'm looking at
2.6%, quite unlikely. That if, unfortunately, you know, if you're born in the bottom quintile in Memphis, that you are going to be able to make it substantially out of poverty. And what's striking to us about some of these numbers is that you might just say, oh, these are very low-income cities in America. Maybe there's no prospect of moving up. But no, take places like Atlanta, take places like Charlotte. These are actually economies that are quite vibrant. Yet you still see very low rates of upward mobility.
Yeah, we hear all about the Atlanta miracle. I mean, you got some kind of in the middle, Nashville 6.2, New Orleans 6.3. Were there surprises to you at the low end? Was Atlanta a surprise? Because we think of it as an economic engine of that region, and yet little mobility.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's why Atlanta is receiving so much attention in all this discussion. Atlanta is not the type of place you might have thought of as being particularly low mobility. And so, you know, we were indeed quite surprised by places like Atlanta, Charlotte, Raleigh, North Carolina.
Can we talk about some of the reasons that you found and how you came to these? I mean, I'm looking at the sort of the big four that you name, large and geographically dispersed middle class. Another way of saying that is sort of what integrated classes living near one another. Better than average schools, a high share of two-parent households, populations engaged with religious and community organizations. How did you figure out those correlations?
Yeah, so I'm happy you emphasized correlation. So I think we can't say for sure what the causal factors are here because we're able to tell you the characteristics of the places that have higher versus lower rates of upward mobility. And what, you know, what we started out looking at being economists was things like tax policy to places with more tax credits for low-income families? Did they have higher rates of upward mobility? And we did find some evidence of that. But we started to realize that there was a lot more variation than could be explained by just variation in tax policies across places. And so that's where some of these other factors really seem to emerge. So for instance, take a place like Atlanta. As David Leonhard was mentioning, it's a very residentially segregated city where low-income people are living in neighborhoods that are quite separated physically from higher-income people.
And the public transportation, not great.
And the public transportation is not great. And so that was a common characteristic that we found of many places with low rates of upward mobility.
Meaning that people end up living in kind of, not really literally, but kind of sealed areas of poverty where they're not, you know, it's not interwoven with affluence. Hard to get on that train and hard to get to where the jobs are potentially.
That's potentially one mechanism. But again, you know, there are other potential mechanisms. So, for example, the quality of schools for low-income kids is likely to be higher in a place where they're living in neighborhoods integrated with higher-income families because there's going to be more funding for the schools, smaller classrooms, better teachers. And we have evidence from other work that that kind of thing really matters for kids' outcomes.
Two-parent households, what's the pattern you saw there?
So the pattern we see there is that areas with more two-parent households have higher rates of upward mobility. But a very important point to keep in mind is even for kids from married families, from two-parent households, rates of upward mobility are lower if they live in areas with high single-parent rates. So this is not just saying that kids from single-parent families have lower outcomes, which we know is the case, but rather it's something about the community as well.
Did you look at the stickiness of where you are at the upper end? I mean, I read an essay recently, Who's Your Daddy? And all about how, I mean, they were talking about Rolling Stone, how Jan Wenner's handing it off to his 22-year-old son. You know, does sort of pride of place, privilege by birth stick?
Stickiness of place is very much correlated with the patterns we're showing you for upward mobility in exactly the way you think. So the places that have high rates of upward mobility also have less stickiness of place at the top. Of the income distribution.
Interesting. Raj Chetty is with us. He is one of four economists who have put out a truly fascinating new study on mobility, upward mobility within this country. We've fallen back somewhat overall as a country compared to others. This used to be our sort of calling card, not so strong now, but within the country, all kinds of variation. Let's go to our listeners. Charlottesville, Virginia, Jerome is calling. Hi, Jerome, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What's your question?
Oh, my question, I thought it was being forward to. I'm rather astonished that race is not a major variable that is under discussion. We've been reducing the whole conversation down to what I think is a relatively simplistic analysis. But in these cities that one is talking about, for example, Salt Lake City at one end of the extreme, there are virtually no African Americans, while in Atlanta is a very high percentage. Address this issue.
Yes, we will right now. Raj, no mean economist. I assume you've done some sophisticated work here. But what about it? You got Salt Lake City, you know, sort of very homogeneous, white, and doing very well there. Atlanta, very different. And I don't know what to make of that. Why isn't it in your list to Jerome's direct question of major factors?
Absolutely. So when you look at the map, Jerome, exactly as you say, you see that places with a higher, larger white population have higher rates of upward mobility, and that correlation is extremely strong. Now, why do we not emphasize that as a factor? Because we find that even for the white people who live in cities like Atlanta or Memphis, rates of upward mobility are much lower. So controlling for the race, looking at people who are white in all cities, rates of upward mobility vary in pretty much the same spatial pattern that we're showing you here.
So you wouldn't look at this and say African Americans in Atlanta may be more heavily represented at the bottom of the income spectrum, and they're not given the same opportunities to rise. Therefore, Atlanta, almost by definition, has lower mobility. You've somehow dealt with that?
So that's not – I don't think that's the correct interpretation, because it's also true that white Americans who are at the bottom of the income distribution in Atlanta also have equally low probabilities of rising.
Yeah, but there's a whole lot more African Americans, let's say, in Atlanta. I'm talking through my hat here. I'm not sure this is true, but – one could imagine that there are more African Americans at the bottom. So the number you end up with could be still influenced by race, or am I wrong?
No, so that's not right, because our statistics are controlling for race in that sense. So we're saying take a white person who's at a given income level. Mm-hmm. That person, if they were in Atlanta versus a comparable white person in a different city, mobility rates are going to be different. We're not just averaging over all the races and saying there are more black people in Atlanta so mobility rates are lower in Atlanta.
Okay. Jerome, I appreciate your call. The Stewart in Nashville, Tennessee. You're on the air, Stewart. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Thank you, Tom, for taking my call. It seems to me, in looking at this map, that there's also no correlation between social services that are provided to people and how much money is spent and upward mobility. And it seems that it calls into question the fundamental premises that a lot of our politicians on both sides have had, which is spending money on social programs means better upward mobility.
So
I'm interested in their comments on that.
Stuart, we'll go to that. Let me ask you. I mean, one thing that they do cite is better than average schools as one of the key factors here. Now, there are also lifestyle things here, two-parent families and so on, but schools, surely that's a pretty essential social service, Stuart.
I agree, but I see in Nashville, and I know this firsthand from having two small children, that we spend much more money on our lower-performing schools than we do on the higher-performing schools. That argument seems to be upside down to me. The social programs that we put in and the money we spend on teachers, on the facilities and everything else is much higher in the lower-performing schools than it is in upper-performing schools.
Stuart, let us pick it up. I'm glad you raised it. Ross Chetty, what about it? Social spending.
So that's, I think, a great point. I mean, you're giving specific examples like Nashville. You're absolutely right that one factor like schools, where we do find a strong correlation with measures of the quality of schools, spending on schools, and upward mobility. But you're always going to find exceptions to that rule. You know, we haven't found the single causal mechanism that's driving this variation. There are multiple factors at play. I will say that even within the schools category, what seems to matter more is less total spending on schools, but more things like the level of test scores, the dropout rates, measures of the direct performance of schools,
performance,
rather than the number of dollars that are being spent.
But what about, I mean, you began this looking at tax issues here, so this is surely relevant. I mean, let's reel it back to Stewart's essential question. Do you find, I don't know if you looked for this, but do you find a relationship between mobility and social spending overall, i.e., does more social spending encourage more mobility up from the bottom?
So we do find a clear correlation between local tax rates, some measure of government social spending, and upward mobility. So that's clearly there in the data. Now, again, though, I caution that that could be coming through various mechanisms. So, for instance, that places with higher levels of social spending, they may also have different levels of inequality. They may also have different types of school systems. And it could be all these other factors that are actually the ultimate root cause of these differences.
You're a big-time young economist. When you look at this map, and it's an amazing map, if you're within the sound of my voice, link through to this map and check it out. All over the country, you can get very detailed about the mobility all over the place. It's just fascinating. But is this a map, Ross Chetty, of a healthy country?
That's a tough question. I would say it's a map showing you that some parts of the country are in pretty good health. That makes me optimistic. That makes me hopeful that we can figure out how to get more Salt Lake Cities, more San Franciscos, more places like the areas in Minnesota. And then there are other places where I think you have to look at this and say, this is probably not where you want to be.
It may speak to why sometimes it's hard to understand one another, because the experiences in different parts of the country are so different.
That's a great point. That's right. It comes back to this question of having this debate about whether the U.S. is the land of opportunity or not may not be the right debate to be having. People are having very different experiences across the country.
And is there a red state, blue state correlation here?
Some people see that in this map. I mean, clearly you see in the South lower rates of upward mobility, but then you can flip that around and say, you know, in some of the Great Plains states, you see very high rates of upward mobility. So I don't
think
you
see that. Which tend to be red as well, tend to be Republican as well. Ross Chetty is with us, Harvard University winner of the John Bates Clark Medal this year for top young economist in the country. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about American cities where you can move up in the world and cities where it is a whole lot harder in a time when upward mobility in this country overall has slowed. Stalled, a big new study tracks for the first time the best and worst places to get ahead. One of its authors, Raj Chetty of Harvard, is with us this hour, a big-time young economist doing work that's turning a lot of heads in this study. Federal Reserve Bank Chairman Ben Bernanke's been talking about this. I mean, all the way back in 2010, here he was on 60 Minutes, the lack of mobility and its consequences.
It's a very bad development. It's creating two societies. And it's based very much, I think, on educational differences. The unemployment rate we've been talking about, if you're a college graduate, unemployment is 5%. If you're a high school graduate, it's 10% or more. It's a very big difference. It leads to an unequal society and a society which doesn't have the cohesion that we'd like to see.
Federal Reserve Bank Chairman Ben Bernanke. All kinds of response here online. You've got people. Selena Gonzalez writes to us, raised by a single mom in Houston on poverty line, now live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, consider myself mid to upper middle class. There's movement. Some of our younger listeners wondering about upward mobility, they'd be happy just to stay where they started. Joey writes, as a student, I might be interested in horizontal mobility because vertical mobility, upward mobility, I guess, sounds to be an early 20th century question. I hope not. We still need that politically and socially and economically in this country. Here's one from Jay on our website. How does the study look at geographic mobility? Does the study only look at people who do not move? Do people who move have different mobility economically? What about that, Raj? Is birthplace destiny? Did you look at all at people who say, hey, this isn't working for me, I'm out of here, and what happens with them?
So our statistics track everyone no matter where they move. So these places, like we were talking about earlier, rural Iowa, which have incredibly rates of high upward mobility, the way that's happening is a huge fraction of those successful kids are moving out.
Oh, so they're ending up in the top quintile somewhere else.
In Boston, in New York, in San Francisco.
So boys, girls, be ambitious. Go get it.
Exactly.
And they do.
And they do. That's the point. They do.
Raj Chetty, please stand by. It is wonderful to have you with us. I want to go to Steamboat Springs, Colorado. And Isabel Sawhill, she's Senior Fellow for Economic Studies and Co-Director of the Center on Children and Families at the Brookings Institution, co-author of Creating an Opportunity Society. Isabel Sawhill, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you, Tom. Nice to be with you.
So I'm looking here and I'm shuffling through all the pages of this, here it is, Steamboat Springs, where you are right now, kind of a off-the-charts area for mobility. I mean, they're up in the 20-plus percent in that part of the country. What do you think of this overall, Isabel, what this new study has found?
I think it's terribly interesting, and it's a level of detail and data that we haven't had before, and therefore very important. I think it's going to probably take us a while to figure out what it all means. I imagine that Raj Chetty would agree with that. It does look as if education and family structure are very key, and I think the economy of where you grew up matters as well. But I do think this question about the more upwardly mobile populations or people are likely to move is something that's complicated. I would like to be able to understand that a little bit better. I think we know, if we think internationally, that people who migrate, including people who migrate to the United States, are often people who are very entrepreneurial, risk-taking and willing to work hard. And so, I think something similar could be going on internally, that people who are upwardly mobile are more likely to move than people who aren't.
What about what this says about our status internationally? I mean, we've seen these numbers come out that show the United States, which was this sort of, you know, jewel in the crown of mobility, at least we thought so for such a long time, is now behind so many others when it comes to upward mobility. You know, children rising from the bottom and getting somewhere. Canada higher than us, Australia higher than us, France, Germany, Japan, all higher than the U.S. Does this speak to that at all? Should we be comforted that we still have significant regions of the country that are in that ball game, or is it the overall number that ultimately counts, Isabel?
Well, I think it's both. First of all, it's quite true that the United States is now a laggard compared to some other countries in terms of the amount of mobility we provide overall to our citizens. But it's also encouraging that there is a lot of diversity across the country, and in some areas of the country we still have high rates of mobility, in other areas we have very low rates. And as I think David Leonhard pointed out, on average, it's not a great story, but it does depend on where you live.
Let's go to Columbus, Ohio. Anthony's calling from there. Anthony, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you? I wonder, being in Columbus, I wonder about Columbus as a place that in the study came out as a place where there is lower mobility.
I'm looking on the map here. It says 5.1% of children from the bottom in Columbus get to the top. Pretty low.
It never was an industrial city, so it didn't have the Rust Belt disaster of other Ohio cities in the 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. It's growing in terms of population. It's the only city in Ohio that's growing that way. And if you live here, you feel like it has a sort of a vibrant economy. So I wonder about Columbus specifically, but also about the other places in the Midwest where you found lower rates of mobility as well.
We will look at it. Raj, how about it? The Midwest overall with the pretty broad swath of low and lowish numbers. And then I don't know what you can say about Columbus in particular, but you hear Anthony. He looks around. It feels pretty vibrant to him. Doesn't really stack up with your number. How can that happen?
So absolutely, in the Midwest, I would say some of the cities have quite low rates of mobility. One thing to keep in mind, Anthony, I think, is you've got to remember that these statistics are coming from kids who grew up in the 1980s and 1990s, and we're only able to see their incomes today because they were growing up at that time, right? So it could well be that things have changed in Columbus, and the kids who are growing up there now, if we were to look at their incomes 30 years from now, 20 years from now, we'd find a different picture. So, you know, we're hoping, actually, that these numbers are not set in stone and that we can change things going forward.
And, you go from Indianapolis, Indiana, low, 4.8%. One titch west, you're in the Lafayette area, and it's 9.3%, twice as high. Maybe it's about time. Maybe it's about a change that you're seeing, Anthony. I appreciate your call. Sarah in Zion, Illinois, up by Chicago. Sarah, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks. I want to bring up the idea that race really does play an issue because historically in the South there was such a high rates of housing discrimination and segregation and lower spending on black schools, which make up a large part of the poor population. And that, so therefore, historically, the conditions that you're talking about are partly exist due to racial discrimination. And I'm curious about where Chicago is. And I know Chicago has a history of housing discrimination and is a very highly segregated city, one of the highest. So I'm thinking that would be lower because of that.
Chicago, 6.1% for kids from the bottom to the top. But Raj, here it is again. Sarah looks around and she's just not buying that there's not a racial factor here.
So I think you've got it exactly right. Race does matter insofar as it affects – so places in the South have higher rates of segregation because perhaps of their historical racial composition. But what we're saying is you shouldn't think of this study as simply saying black people have lower rates of upward mobility than white people and there are more black people in the South. What we're saying is because of the patterns – of segregation that perhaps emerged due to racial differences, even white people in the South have lower rates of upward mobility. Because if you're low income in the South and you're white, you're likely to be living in a different neighborhood, separated from higher income folks. You might have access to worse schools and so forth, all of which I think you captured perfectly. That's exactly the idea.
Isabel Sawhill in Colorado. There's been a lot of talk in recent years about people being stuck in their class, low class, whatever their race. Whites included, Isabel.
That's right, but there are racial differences. We have done studies that have looked at middle-class black families to see if their children, how their children do compared to white kids born into middle-class families. And the black kids that are born into middle-class families tend to disproportionately fall down the ladder, while the white kids tend to move up more.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there is a racial difference, and we don't exactly understand what it's due to. Race, of course, is very correlated with growing up in a single-parent family. It is also correlated with going to poor and segregated schools in the past. So it's very hard to sort out what's going on here. But I have quite a lot of sympathy with Jerome and Sarah and others who have pointed out to the fact that there does seem to be an impact of race. Now, Raj is saying what the impact is, the racial composition of the area that you live in, not race per se. And I think it's a complicated story.
Let's go to Madison, Wisconsin, and Daryl. Hi, Daryl. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is an excellent opportunity for everyone to move up the mobile ladder. Actually, energy efficiency and renewable energy is our economic future, both nationally and globally. And we have to teach high school students various elements of energy efficiency, building energy efficiency and so forth, heating and air conditioning and whatnot. There are terrible inefficiencies in this area, and there are unlimited opportunities. There is no reason why that every city can't become more even in every area of the country and even of the world become more even in upward mobility economically.
Daryl, I got your point on the environmental front. We've heard that from President Obama often. Let me ask you, you're in Madison, Wisconsin, 10.2%. That's quite high. That's quite strong, that is, of poor kids who can get to the top. Milwaukee, not far from you to the east, 5.6%, about half of what you've got there. How do you explain the difference between Milwaukee and Madison, Daryl?
Well, actually, Milwaukee could be brought up. Milwaukee has, quite a few African-American people in that area.
But we're supposedly, accounting for that.
That's not the reason. The reason is if you teach the high school students these technical skills, and they're easy, they're not hard. I've been in that field since the mid-1970s.
Yep.
And they can, I mean to tell you, they can become entrepreneurs and they can move into any area of it they want to. And it will give everybody a chance to move up the ladder and increase the economy, jobs, you name it.
Daryl, we've got it. We hear the confidence and the hope. Raj, what do you say?
I actually grew up in Milwaukee, went to high school there.
Great.
And from my personal experience, Milwaukee, I was lucky to be from an affluent family, went to a great private school in Milwaukee. And it's the type of place where, if you're in that environment, you can be very successful. But then you also get the sense that Milwaukee is quite segregated and there are many kids who don't have great schools, who are quite isolated. And so it doesn't surprise me that Milwaukee is, unfortunately, one of the lowest mobility cities in the U.S. Madison looks really different.
Let's go to Toronto, Canada. Dave is calling. Dave, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a person that travels throughout the U.S. a lot, well, mostly down the East Coast a lot. And I'm not a political person, but what I do find within the U.S. is this. The more progressive a community tends to be, I think the mobility rates tend to be higher. Now, I find that when I go down south and you talk about things like universal medical care and these kind of things, and the strong funding for education, their eyes roll over. They think it's some kind of a socialist plot. They talk about that. Oh, you're that Massachusetts thing. But I'm saying a lot of places like Massachusetts have higher levels of mobility. And I just think, the more progressive a state or community, I wouldn't say a state, but a community is, the more mobility you're going to see within that place. That's just
Dave, we've got it. You're breaking up a little bit there. Isabel, let me take that to you. I mean, Raj says, well, you've got exceptions in the Great Plains, but I have to say, it is kind of striking. Looking at this map, it looks kind of red and blue. The red, i.e. Republican areas, very broadly speaking, less mobility. That doesn't mean they don't have economic strength in them. Atlanta's strong, but mobility, the American dream part. And the blue areas, California, the Northeast, some of that Northwest that's quite blue, they've got some of the highest numbers here. What do you make of that, Isabel?
I do see a kind of red-blue tint to this map, and I think that that's a good point. This is a story in which there are many factors playing a role, but I think that a community that cares about other people in the community and is willing to levy taxes and pay for social services and good education, that makes a difference. And where communities are not cohesive, where the public is not willing to support people who look different than they do or are poorer than they are, and we are sorting out as a country by income in a way that we have not seen in the past. We have a lot more economic segregation than we used to, and that means that the rich and the poor live in different places, and the wealthy have less knowledge of and empathy for people who aren't doing as well. And that affects our politics, and that affects what we're willing to do to promote upward mobility.
Raj, I guess that also means that people at the lower end of the income scale, if we're economically segregated by where we live, they just don't see those patterns of life and the sort of way that the more successful tier is going about its business, going about its life. They may not have those models just around them, ambient.
There could absolutely be role model effects here, right? So it could be that in a place like Boston or in San Jose, you're coming into contact with people who you see as examples of where you could take your life. And in some of these other cities, which we're seeing very low rates of mobility, very high rates of segregation, you don't have those particular examples. I think teasing out exactly why we're finding this correlation with segregation, is it about role models? Is it about schools? Is it about access to jobs? That's the important big next step here.
Don't forget two-parent families right up there in your top four. I have seldom seen a piece of work that got so many conversations going, partly because it takes it to everybody's hometown. This is as important as it gets for a country like ours with its history and with its need for a kind of political cohesiveness at some level, the sense that we're all in this game together. Here we see where we are and maybe where we are not. Raj Chetty, to you and your team who did all this work, thank you very much. This is terrific. We'll be thinking about this one for a long time. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Isabel Sahil, you are always so generous with your insights, and we're grateful to you for being with us today from the Brookings Institution. Isabel, thank you for joining us from Colorado.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, check out the link at onpointradio.org to this map. You can play with it, I'd say, all day long. It is really interesting. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.